Hi, this is Ryan Dawson of the Anti-Neocon Report. Joining me today is Sut Jolly. He is the executive producer of a new film, The Occupation of the American Mind, Israel's Public Relations War in the United States. He's also a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Anaheim. And we are going to talk about this film. It is narrated by Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, whom I did an interview with and met last March at the Stop Israeli Influence Conference in Washington, D.C. with Ermep and Grant Smith. Professor Jolly, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good. Great to be here.
This movie, this film, The Occupation of the American Mind, is a follow-up of a previous film we were talking just prior to the recording, Peace Propaganda in the Promised Land. How is this different from that film, or what is the focus on this? Why do you say The Occupation of the American Mind?
Yeah, the film is, we did Peace Propaganda, Promised Land in 2004. And it's been, you know, I think it's been used in quite a lot of places. So I think it was a very useful film for, you know, for people wanting to know more about the conflict and especially how it was framed. And Peace Propaganda, the Promised Land was really a kind of contrast between American coverage and British coverage, just to show how slanted and distorted the American coverage was. But it didn't get too much into the actual kind of mechanisms of it, didn't get into the history that much, didn't get into especially the lobby. And then, of course, in 2008, we have the first Gaza war. And again, by that time, the propaganda campaign was in such full tilt that I thought it deserved to be looked at specifically on its own. And so the Gaza wars the coverage of the Gaza wars are a big part of what we do. And that's what really prompted the new film was the attacks.
Yeah, Peace Propaganda in the Promised Land was prior to Gaza, prior to the settlements being removed in Gaza as well for Bush's roadmap.
Right. There was within this in these issues, things keep changing. As you said, it was before the 2005 so-called withdrawal.
Relocation. They just put the settlements in the West Bank and charged us a lot of money for it. But that's something else that wasn't covered in the media either.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about the psychology of this conflict.
So you asked why it was called The Occupation of the American Mind.
Yeah, I think the title is, The Occupation of the American Mind. It's very fitting. I was trying to throw a softball there, but what's the reason for that wording?
Yeah, well, the focus of the film is really about American public opinion. And it makes the case what Israel is doing would not be possible without the support of America, the American government, American elites, American corporations, etc. It's not as though Israel is working against what the U.S. Wants to do. But for that support, that American support to go on unchallenged, means that in a democracy, when elected officials could potentially have to face pressure from their citizens. What you have to do is you have to make sure that there's no pressure coming from the public for any kind of change. And to do that, and for that to happen, you have to keep them, you have to have them live in a state of denial and manipulation. So they don't literally understand the situation, and therefore, they don't get upset about it. And therefore, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, the prerequisite of that is an occupation of American media and American public opinion, which makes American support unchallenged.
I think it's also confused a bit with religious history versus actual history, where people are just under the assumption that Israel has always existed, it's always been a Jewish majority, and it's their land because God said so. And these Palestinians are the ones, they reverse the situation and they have the Palestinians as the invaders and occupiers who are lobbing missiles at them every day. This seems to be the narrative. Even before any rockets were ever fired, then they would say suicide bombings. And before there were any suicide bombings, they didn't really have an excuse, but they just pretended like this was the situation, that there were these innocent Jews fleeing from World War II and these evil Palestinians are always attacking them for no reason other than because they're anti-Semitic or something. and yeah, well, no mention of the occupation or the blockade or any of that.
Yeah, I mean, in the film, we look at this document that was produced by Frank Luntz, who is a public relations expert, and he did some research for these Israeli pro-Israeli groups about what language works and what doesn't work. And one of the most, and in the film, we say the three most important words, if you want to understand the nature of the propaganda campaign, to do exactly what you said, so that people literally don't know what's going on. So that people literally think that it is, that it's the Palestinians who are somehow in the wrong here. Or they think that this has been going on for hundreds of years, and it's this endless cycle of violence, and it's all based on religion. You've got to keep people in that state of denial, because if they knew the truth, the truth of the matter is, this is one of the least complex conflicts in the world. Yeah. It is actually absolutely very clear what's going on.
I compare it to Iraq. I say, why were Iraqis shooting at Americans? Because we invaded and occupied their country. I mean, it's pretty obvious. We went over there, destroyed cities, and of course they hate us because of that. But if you skip the invasion and occupation, it would be very confusing. Why are they shooting at us?
One of the things that Israel learns is that it's important when, history starts in the narrative. For example, the rockets, these useless rockets from Hamas.
Missiles, that's another word.
Yeah. Well, it's rocket, and I've heard them described, more as firecrackers than as anything else.
They don't have warheads, they don't have propulsion systems, they're more like potato guns.
But there's never any coverage of the provocations that Israel has done to provoke Hamas into this response. If Hamas didn't exist, Israel would have to invent them, because they actually did. But they developed them as an opposition to the secular Fatah. But you have to keep the focus on terrorism, and therefore history doesn't start until the first response from the Palestinians. Everything that comes before that is forgotten, and therefore if you don't know any of that, it doesn't make all you have is these what you've been told is crazy Palestinians, crazy Arabs, attacking our friends in Israel.
Like that's ever been backed in Hollywood, the crazy Arab.
Well, no, and there's a. I mean, in the film, we actually had a section on Islamophobia, because that's actually it's actually a very necessary part of understanding how the pro-Israel anti-Palestinian propaganda works. But we didn't have time to put it in, and so there is a much much larger context. But
even more than that, just the whole orientalization of the area. Like, yes, there's Islamophobia, but defining people by a religion is already a step in the wrong direction. They did the same thing with, why are there Japanese kamikazes? Oh, they were just because they're in the emperor. Maybe they didn't want you to blow up Japan. I don't know.
Yeah.
You always have suicide bombers. In Vietnam, there were suicide bombers. World War II had suicide bomber. And they're not Muslim. Like, it doesn't matter what their religion is.
No, I mean, actually,
desperation, that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes say to my students, imagine what would happen if suddenly, Russia occupied America. What would you do? You're just going to go along meekly with it? No, you're going to fight back. And I tell you, I bet it wouldn't be very long before you'd be strapping on a suicide vest.
I might join the Russians. No. Given our guy. Well, if it was Hillary Clinton, I think I'd join the Russians.
Right. But one of the things I was saying was, in terms of this notion of keeping the focus away from history, Frank Luntz says the focus of any of the propaganda campaign of how to get people to understand this is by focusing on terror, not territory. And he has this data. He has this focus group data that shows the more Americans know about the situation, that is, the more they know about history, the more they know about the occupation, the more they are likely to be critical of Israel and to be more pro-Palestinian. And so, you know, Lunt says, you know, like any good magician, you've got to, it's a matter of deflection, that the real issues are over here, you know, in the occupation, in the territories, in the conflict over land and who's going to have land and whose rights are being, you know, are going to be represented, etc.
But you trading can't have land for trade. Peace. That was one of their best phrases, trading land for peace. We can't trade land for peace. Well, you can't trade someone else's land. I mean, how can you simultaneously occupy your neighbors and then act like you even want peace?
Well, you've got to make sure that history doesn't start in the occupation. You've got to make sure that history, the way that you convince people of this, is that you have to forget about history, you have to forget about reality, and instead you have to focus on this category of terrorists. Mm. You know, to understand it. So the only way that you can understand that Americans who are the target of this campaign, the way Americans understand the Middle East is, as you said, this is about religion. This is about, you know, Muslims versus Jews. This has been, you know, been going on for many years. It's about civilization or not civilization. And so they live in that mythic history where there's never any solution and where the Arabs are always the bad guys. And you don't actually live in real history. And again, what Luntz's research showed was that the more people know about the history, the more critical they are of Israel. And so I don't think it's any surprise that on college campuses, you know, you have the development of, you know, things like the BDS movement or but didn't come from campuses or SJPs. Because once students are exposed to a different way of thinking about this, once they're exposed to, you know, to the real world in many ways, their opinions change. And that's what this propaganda campaign, you've got to occupy the American mind to make sure that they don't actually come to a full understanding of it. Because if they did, I'm pretty convinced if the American people actually understood what was going on in Israel, that there would be a shift in public opinion.
I would hope so, but I'm not really sure because I don't know if they will, because of American exceptionalism, even when they know something, they deny it. It's like the children starving in Yemen or that the U.S. has been arming ISIS or any like the Contra affair, right? Things come out and they just, they're looking for an excuse, no matter how flimsy it is, that whatever fits their narrative of we're always right, that's what they're going to believe. And an overwhelming amount of evidence has no effect on these people because they don't want to believe it.
Yeah, it doesn't have an effect on, you know, true believers as well. It's not going to have an effect on Christian evangelicals who, you know, for them it's not about evidence, it's just about the word of God.
That is
so, but there's enough of a population that if you could get to them and get them to start thinking critically. I mean, I think we're actually at an early stage of this already. I think the fact that the Bernie Sanders has started talking differently about Israel Palestine.
Yeah, he did a complete 180 because he totally used to say, oh, Hamas is firing missiles every day and all that. He just said all the same things, and he's starting to change his mind.
The reason I think he's starting to change his mind is there's pressure coming from below. That, you know, that the Bernie movement actually is an amalgamation of different social movements.
Yeah, his supporters are much more aware than his opponent.
And so essentially his supporters, to appease his supporters or to essentially signal to them, look, I understand, I'm on your side. But he was driven to take this position, you know, not a position, but driven to actually say something. Shouldn't be very controversial, right? All he said was we should treat the Palestinians as human beings.
Yeah.
He refused to see
AIPAC as well, which was a good step. But that kind of exceptionalism I'm talking about exists with the Bernie supporters too, because here you have a guy that, other than the second Iraq war vote, you know, he supported sanctions on Iraq that killed 500,000 children. He wanted regime change in 1998. He supported the Kosovo war, the coup in Ukraine. He supports moderate rebels in Syria. He's just like Hillary Clinton or any of the rest of them, except for his second Iraq war vote, which was a vote against Bush, not the war, because he wanted a regime change before when Bill Clinton was president. And they can ignore all that. They can ignore him given $1.5 trillion to Lockheed Martin for the F-35. All his corporatism and bending over for Wall Street, he is exactly like all the things they hate, and yet they put their hope in him anyway. And they did the same thing with Obama. They thought Obama was anti-war because he's a Democrat rather than a Republican. But Obama supported torture and drone strikes, so does Bernie. Obama, you know, increased the war in Afghanistan. And they just are able to ignore all of this because they hate Republicans so much. And that's what I'm saying is the psychology is not – people don't stand for anything. They stand against other things. And they're going – they hate Trump or they hate Hillary. That's what it is. They don't have any – ideology.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting to see, because I think the way in which the Obama campaign and the Sanders campaign are different is that, you know, one was driven really by race and was driven by, I think, much, you know, a charismatic leader who was starting to and drew groups to him. I think the Bernie approach is the opposite, which is social movements have existed, but Bernie has become the kind of focus for them. But when the election happens, those movements are not going to go away. Those movements, and that was a mistake under Obama. I think a lot of the people put too much faith in Obama. And you're right, Obama. I mean, he's a mainstream Democrat. You know, he's not radical. He's not he's not even really a social Democrat.
So is Bernie, other than his rhetoric about taxing the 1% more. If you look at his actual record. He voted with Hillary Clinton 93% of the time. He voted with the Democrats 96% of the time. He's not.
I agree. When it comes to foreign policy, I think there is almost no difference. And that's one of the things when you run for the essentially the CEO of the American Empire, you've kind of had to accept that your job is going to be to run the empire. That's one of the job requirements of running for as president of the United States.
We had Lincoln Chafee and O'Malley in the Democratic debates, both of whom were anti-war, and they didn't get any steam whatsoever. We had Ron Paul before that, who's not only anti-war, but against all this corporatism and bailouts, and he could not get the support from the left either. If he had run as a Democrat, they would have supported him. It's that basic. It's basic tribalism. They picked a team, and it's like a sports team for these people.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping not. I think actually we're at a moment where people are starting to see through the identity stuff.
I hope so.
I'm actually very hopeful that no matter what happens, in November, or whoever gets a nomination, it's going to be about the energy that has sustained the Sanders movement, which is not about him, but the energy coming from below. Whether that can be sustained then as a movement against whether it's going to be the neoliberalism of Hillary Clinton or the craziness I'm not quite sure what Donald Trump is going to do.
But no one really knows what he's going to do because he flip-flops all the time. So does Hillary. But we know how bad Hillary will be. So you can either gamble on disaster or you can get a for sure disaster. And there's nothing to really get excited about. But I mean, Bernie had some good things even on foreign policy. He accepted the Iran deal, at least. Others wouldn't even do that.
So. Yeah, I mean, as Noam Chomsky says about Bernie, he says, if he was in Europe, he'd be like a solid social democrat.
Yeah,
he's not a socialist. He's not, all those things that he says himself he is. He is essentially, his positions are essentially the positions of someone like Dwight Eisenhower.
Pretty much, yeah. I've said that before.
Yeah, who's a Republican, the Republican president of the United States. There's not much difference between them. And so you have to, for me, politics, mainstream politics, it's not real politics. It's, incremental change. And for me, it's actually not so much about the election, but about, I think, this energy that Bernie has either unleashed or is bringing together in some way. And I really don't think that is going to go away. I don't think we're going to be in the Obama moment where everyone is enraptured by an individual thinking that, Obama was in one sense, that this is the brilliance of his campaign. Obama was like a Rorschach ink blot test.
Right.
Which is you see whatever you want to see in it.
Just you say something very vague, whatever psychologically, fill in the blank, like say something like, I'm for change or hope. And these are just platitudes that mean nothing, because you can say, well, I want change and I'm for hope. Like, of course you are, but he's not going to give you the changes you wanted. He increased the size of Gitmo. He tripled the size of the war in Afghanistan. He invaded Libya.
You have to remember, support for Obama was never support for, for a set of policies. Because, people actually didn't know what the policies were, though. They didn't care. I remember just after the election, when he expanded the war in Afghanistan, and, people who supported him were outraged. And he said, did you not listen to me during the campaign? I said I was going to do this.
Yeah. Well, they just saw a black guy and got excited.
So I think the support of Obama was not about policy. It was about something else. It was about America's relation and white America's relationship, to guilt.
It was signaling. Yeah. I see a lot of that signaling. And it's something else, too. We see all these pundits afterwards saying, isn't it something that we got to fill in the biological category to do this? And to me, when I hear stuff like that, I'm thinking, you're prejudiced. Because any normal person that just, Obama's left-handed, too. You want to throw that up there? Like, who cares? When you see everything as the first biological category to do something, you're making a pecking order. You're saying, well, there's like a white guy and a lady and a black guy and then this and then this and then that. Like, why do you even pay attention to what all, like,
big movies? Well, I think you have to look at the symbolic value of these things. 1992, I wrote a book with a colleague of mine, Justin Lewis, on The Cosby Show. We talked to ordinary people, black and white, about how they made sense of the show and what they got out of it. And it was clear that the kind of symbolic value of seeing a black person represented in a human way, in a decent human way, was revolutionary for especially black people, that they had never seen this before.
Doctor and a lawyer and a family, and they raised their kids. Never came up on the show.
Yeah, but that was part of the fantasy. But to see a doctor, you can say, well, they never talked about other things about race, but that was part of the deal. They wouldn't have got the viewing figures they did if they talked explicitly about race. But they talked about race all the time in the fact that they were on screen, and they were a black family.
What's the name of the book?
The name of the book is called Enlightened Racism, The Cosby Show and the Myth of the American Dream.
I think The Cosby Show had a huge impact, because I know people who were racist, but they would make exception. They'd be like, well, not if they're like Bill Cosby. He's one of the good ones. That was the kind of thing they had in their head. And I go, well, what's the bad one? And their image was this sort of subculture that was shown on MTV. And I'm like, a subculture, not a genetic disposition, right?
And which they think is then actually that's the majority of black people.
Because that's the majority of what they saw on television.
Right, but at the same time, they saw Cosby.
Right.
And so it allowed white people, especially the South, saying, look, I'm not racist because, I love the Cosby Show. But,
I would argue the North is the problem, because in the South, people live with black people, so they know how they really are. It's the people who don't have exposure to black people who have to get it from TV and develop these prejudices. Because I'm from the South, and I always saw that something else that's always on TV, that the Southerner is so racist and ignorant, and it just isn't true. It's just not like that. We play sports together. We're all integrated in the South. It's up in the Northeast where you have police killing people on film and getting acquitted. That's just another prejudice, in my opinion. That's another Hollywood stereotype against the South. It gets really demonized about it, because obviously the South was like that. But that's because they're the only area that could be like that. That's where almost half of Africans live. Is completely in the South. So yeah, there's going to be conflict, because that's where people are. That's where Latinos are too. It's on next to the border. So that's where it's going to exist. But in the southern parts of the United States, they're far more integrated and have gotten it over it, because they've been living together for so many generations. Whereas I think up in Northeast and some other areas where it's not like that, or in the middle of Ohio or something, then that's where you have your much more prejudice, I feel.
Well, because they're then relying upon how the the media, the mainstream media as a whole, tells the story of race. So in the book that we did, Cosby, and again, Obama used exactly the same strategy. In fact, it's essentially he used the Bill Cosby strategy to become president, which was you appeal to black people on the basis of race, and then you appeal to white people on the basis of guilt, on the basis of the racial history, and then look, I can now vote for a black man and look how great I am. And that's exactly the strategy that Cosby used. And so what we said in that was, the effect of Cosby was kind of one step forward, which was, we have to recognize, and I think with Obama as well, for all we want to say about his actual the actual reality, the fact of having a black man represented or, elected as president of the United States, symbolically, that is very, very significant. For a country, with the history of the United States, around race and around slavery and around Jim Crow segregation, etc., to have a black man be president of the United States, symbolically, it just is, it means something.
Well, he was certainly better than McCain anyway.
To not recognize that is real, even though we think, right, people are just taken in by race and it's really all about class, that symbolic aspect. And the same, I don't think it's going to be actually, I say the same. Hillary's trying to paint it in the same way. It's the first woman president. So symbolically, that is going to mean something for a lot of people. And that's not foolishness. That's in the history, with the history of exploitation and suppression in the past, to have a symbol that looks like this, that's the one step forward.
I think people are mature enough with that issue, though. With women, I think it's so obvious that we have equal sexes. It's so because that the guilt and the need to signal isn't quite as strong because it's like, oh, of course we could have a female president if we had the right person running or whatever. I don't think it's necessary for people to signal there because when people are really mature and they're actually not sexist at all or racist at all, then they lose their need to signal. To say, oh, I got to vote to prove how non-sexist I am. I'm going to vote for a woman and show it can be done. They just see her as another candidate. Most people. There are a few.
Well, also that, and I think that's where she's, that's where she's failing. But again, the symbolic nature of politics is not unimportant. I mean, we live in the world through symbols. We engage the world through stories, and if that story resonates with you, then you got to kind of take account of that. And I think there's no point in denying the way that Obama resonated with large numbers of people, black and white, in 2008. That's just the same way that Cosby did as well. That Cosby, people saw in Cosby something, something good. In black people saw in Cosby the humanity, and white people saw in Cosby how great they were by being able to interact with his black family.
He always
but made that, that, was, that was the one step forward. And then we said, what happens is there's two steps back. Because then that image of Cosby or that image of Obama is used as a way to say, well, why aren't the other black people like this?
Maybe why we need a Cosby show for Palestinians or for Arabs, where it's just an Arab family, but they don't bring up religion or anything. It's just showing that, look, we're just like you. We have the same problems you do.
Well, as a first step, so if you could get Israelis to identify with, in some way, a Palestinian family outside of the conflict, if you could get them to connect with them, thinking that these are ordinary human beings, that would be a first giant step forward.
I think it would be huge. I want to ask you about some of the basics of the conflict, because you and I are maybe a little inside baseball saying, oh, people don't know this, people don't know that. Talk about the settlements and the occupation. What is going on there? Because I don't think people know when we say words like, oh, the occupation, what do you mean? What is the West Bank? Isn't it Palestine? The basic knowledge isn't there. Could you just explain, what is Israel doing to the Palestinians?
Well, I mean, you've got to make sure that people don't know. That's the first step. And in fact, the first place I kind of started off on this, even before Peace Propaganda Promised Land, it actually kind of pushed me into doing Peace Propaganda Promised Land, was I was teaching this large lecture class at the University of Massachusetts, 18-year-old kids, you know, at a fairly liberal university. And I asked them a question. I asked them a factual question. Not an opinion question, not what they thought about the conflict, but what they knew about the conflict. And so I asked them a question. I said, okay, which of the following countries has been continually condemned in the United Nations for occupying someone else's land in the Middle East? So it was an objective question, the answer to which, of course, is Israel. When I was doing the survey, between 58 and 63% of my students thought that the Palestinians were, in fact, occupying someone else's land.
Wow.
The Palestinians were in the wrong. And that's what got me into thinking about this, which is how can you have this flip of reality? Well, that requires work. I mean, as someone who studies advertising and public relations and propaganda, I know that those kinds of beliefs or that kind of knowledge doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out as the end result of the stories that people have been exposed to. And so I started then to look at the stories that people have to be able to understand this conflict, which is very simple. You know, it's very simple. In 1948, you know, Israel is created driving out, 700,000 Palestinians from what became Israel. That Israel essentially takes over by the end of the war. They take over 72% of the land. And so suddenly you have this huge demographic change in what's happening in Palestine. And the Palestinians are restricted to 22% of the land. And then in 1967, which I think is the next thing, Israel then invades that 22% and takes it over. And so when people talk about the occupation, they're talking about the military occupation of the West Bank and until recently of Gaza by the Israeli military, and essentially treating the entire population of Palestinians, which on the West Bank I think is now close to 4 million, treating them essentially as political prisoners. So when people hear the term occupation, you should think of, if you want the occupation, you should think of Germans in France in the Second World War. And again, then the resistance movements that developed against that as well. So it's a very simple conflict to understand. It's a very, very simple conflict to understand. You don't need to be an expert in history. You can actually understand it if you read the right thing in about half an hour.
Yeah, I think so. There's the war in 56 there too. But yeah, it's pretty simple. And what is a settlement? I mean, I call them racial colonies. They used to call them neighborhoods. The sort of in-between word, I guess, is settlement. But I don't think people understand what a settlement actually is.
Yeah, well, a settlement is exactly that. It's a colony which has been set up in occupied land in which the only people who can live there are Jews. That figure is now around 600,000 people live in this Jewish-only territory that's been taken over from Palestinians. A settlement is on illegally occupied land, and it has moved populations of Jews into it. And again, has constructed this incredible network of roads that link the settlements to Israel proper, to which only and on which only Jews can travel, and Palestinians are left to travel through these horrendous checkpoints in this military occupation on the West Bank.
Only Jews can buy and sell there too. They are restricting. I just talked to an Israeli settler a few days ago, and he was saying he's a libertarian, so he's such a rebel because he goes and he buys olive oil and eggs and things from the Arabs. But if he was caught, he could get in a lot of trouble for that, because they're in the settlements. They are not allowed to even buy from anybody other than other Jews. They're economically, they've sanctioned off the Palestinians as well. So it's not only the highways and the houses. They can't do business with each other either.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're living in segregated areas. I think if you want a definition of apartheid, the settlements are a very good place to start.
it might be worse than apartheid. Usually in an apartheid, they're using the underclass. In this one, they're exterminating them. Some of these settlements have also been, it's not like they just found some open land and started building houses. They demolished the houses of the people who used to live there, like in Tel Aviv.
House evictions and house demolitions are a part of how the settlements come about. And again, you're right, that the settlements aren't just chosen haphazardly. They're chosen to occupy the best agricultural land on the West Bank. And more importantly, they're chosen to make sure that Israel maintains control of the aquifers that are in the West Bank. So this is the occupation of the West Bank, you know, is in one sense an old-fashioned kind of imperialist thing where they just want the resources. I mean, again, Israel could not exist without the resources that now come from the West Bank.
Well, they could buy the water, but yeah. It's a creeping annexation of the West Bank.
I don't think it's creeping. I think that's been since 1993, since the peace process started. I mean, the real name for that, as Norman Finkelstein says, you know, if you want to be honest, there's nothing about peace going on in that. I mean, the notion that this is a peace process is a fiction. That anyone who's looking at this in any kind of accurate way, we just see what it is. It's not a peace process. It is an annexation process. To such an extent now, the 1 in 10 Israelis now live in these settlements. And so the possibility of doing anything about them, you know, has become even more difficult because just the numbers of people now. And normally the people in the settlements are also the ones who are the most kind of rabid and dogmatic, you know, and are the most zealot.
Yeah, you have your hyper-Zionists, and you also have your economic settlers, because these are subsidized, so people who just want a free house go to these settlements, and that's like the guy I was talking to. He wasn't super religious, but he still taking advantage of the situation, and it is what it is, but the settlement process, was that something else that Frank Luntz came up with? Because I know in Peace Propaganda in the Promised Land, they expose this as well. They say, they call them Jewish neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, that was the memo that was actually sent out in CBS to tell people not to call these settlements anymore, but to call them neighborhoods. Because, a neighborhood is just a nice, natural place. It's like the neighborhood I live in. And therefore, it takes away the fact of colonization. Again, Luntz in this report is very clear that the major thing that they've got to deal with when it comes to American public opinion is the occupation and is the settlements, and so they have to think about how the settlements, they can't be called settlements, they can't be called colonies. That's why even in the New York Times they did an editorial recently in which the term occupied is now put into quotation marks. And that's the job of propaganda, is to make sure that people don't even see the reality. But so you can't even call it occupation anymore. You can't even call it occupied. You have to call it the disputed territories. And if it's a disputed territories, well, this stuff goes on all the time. People have different claims on land and so.
They want to act like, the history's so complicated, you'll never get your head around it. No, an army stole land and protects it. They have a standing army. There's a wall as well, and that's something else. People have compared this ridiculous wall that Trump wants to build to the wall that Israel already built. And I point out that, Trump's not even close to being as bad as what the Israelis are doing. Like, you can think that building a wall across the border on Mexico is ridiculous. Fine, I agree. But, and the purpose is supposedly to keep out illegal immigrants. But in Israel, that wall is not even on their border, and it has nothing to do with immigration. It's about annexing land.
Clearly. It's literally about redrawing the boundaries between Israel and the occupied territory by building this wall that encompasses, then, I think, about 10% of the land on the West Bank.
It's the size of Chicago that they've taken away, and the settlements are peppered all in between the Green Line and the wall, on top of the aquifers, like you said. But people assume the wall is on their border. Well, it isn't. And
No. That's the whole function of the wall. It's an annexation wall. It's not a separation barrier.
It's not a security fence, like Hillary Clinton calls it.
it's an expansion barrier.
An annexation wall. That's what I'm going to start calling it, the annexation wall.
Yeah, it's an annexation wall. Yeah.
It's very important to call things what they really are, because they've taken our language from us, and that is something.
I agree. I mean, that's why we did an interview in the film. We have a couple of clips with Norman Finkelstein. He's been talking about this forever, and he's really clear on this when he says, talks about the 93, when he talks about the peace process, that it's not a peace process, it's an annexation process. And in terms of this idea that it's really difficult to know the history of people, one of the things I do when I teach this in my classes at the University of Massachusetts is, before you can really get into the media coverage, you actually have to say something about the situation. You have to get people to kind of understand the history of it. And so I do one class on just the history of it, on nothing else other than, so we start from, we start actually, I think, in the 19th century, and then, move forward into the history. And so I did this, and one of my students came up to me and said, that was the most radical class you've ever taught, because you gave the truth. We looked at the history of Israel-Palestine, and until now, I've been living in this idea that it was so difficult, that it's so complex, that there's no way to understand it. And when you think that, then you're not going to try and understand it. Then you're going to rely upon, simple categories like, civilized and uncivilized, or, terrorist or Western.
Oh, they've been fighting for thousands of years, and there's no way we can do anything. It makes you have a defeatist attitude.
Yeah, once you've said that, that's a kind of throwing your arms up in the air and saying there's nothing we can do. These people are just fighting all the time. When in fact, the reality, of course, is that it's actually a very recent history, and that Americans have a direct role to play in it, because their government is the government that is making this possible. So they are complicit in the occupation of the West Bank, which is why there has to be an occupation of the American mind from Israeli PR. You've got to make sure they don't understand.
It was the British at first, but from 1963 onward, it's been the Americans backing the Israelis. The British at first, they wanted that buffer for the Suez Canal, and the British and the French and Israelis went to war with Egypt in 1956, and it was Eisenhower that put an end to it and put the peacekeepers there. But after Kennedy was killed, they did a complete 180, and America has backed Israel ever since and has been subsidizing them for a long time, $3.5 billion a year. As of last summer, $4.9 billion a year. But since you work in university, I want to ask you this too. Did you have any fears of just talking about this at all? I mean, is there anything like this? Wars are bad, killing people is bad. It should be simple, but the label of anti-Semitism gets thrown out there anyway, and it's kind of like accusing someone of rape. You never, even if you did nothing, you can't really walk away clean from that.
No, I mean, that's the other strategy. One strategy is to control the narrative, and the other strategy is to make sure that anyone who breaks that narrative and tells another narrative is labeled immediately as an anti-Semite and as a racist, and is therefore someone whose views you shouldn't, take into account. I mean, for me, I have to admit, I started teaching in 1985, and I have to admit that I didn't really deal with this issue in the first, I would say, 10 years of my career. And it wasn't because I didn't know about it. I knew about it, right? But in one sense, it was like, do I know enough about it to be able to do a class? Because I'm going to be attacked. And therefore, it was, in one sense, it was my own cowardice around this issue. And plus, do I want to be... do I want to be accused of being a racist? And in fact, to my great shame, I actually didn't do anything on this for the first 10 years. And then actually I saw there was, as I said, I work at the University of Massachusetts, and there's a place called Hampshire College, which is very close by. And there was teaching a great third world intellectual. His name was Iqbal Ahmed. He's an incredible, incredible guy, and he was teaching at the university. He was teaching at Hampshire College. When I say he's a great guy, I mean when they had a celebration for him, and the people that came to speak were Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, anyone else that you care to think of. And when they had this celebration, the final person who was speaking was Edward Said, the author of Orientalism. And he got up and he had tears streaming down his face. And he said, these are tears of happiness because I'm here to celebrate Ekbal's work, because when the rest of the world forgot the Palestinians, Ekbal did not, and paid a great price for that. And I thought, I realized myself that I had actually been censoring myself around this because of what I thought would be potential, you know, the problems of it. And that was when I started to teach this in class, and that's when I started then to really work on a film or an idea of a film around it. But you have to get past that fear. You have to get past that fear. Now, I must admit, the one thing, and more academics should do it, because especially those academics with tenure, that's what the protection of tenure gives you, is the ability to actually, you know, talk about controversial issues.
That's the purpose of it, right? Yeah.
And I wish more people did. I wish more people used tenure. And so today,
well, if you don't have it, there are consequences. Norman Finkelstein is an example of that. Like, you have to have that, or you cannot talk about this issue without.
No, absolutely. I mean, that was Alan Dershowitz, you know, preventing him from getting tenure at DePaul University. It's one of the most horrendous cases of injustice that I've seen. You know, here's someone who's, you know, Norman Finkelstein, here's someone who's written 6 books, you know, endless articles, is regarded as the world's, you know, one of the world's great experts on this. And yet, you know, because of his, this is what they said, because of the tone of his remarks, because of his incivility, he was not going to get tenure.
Because of the tone of, oh, yeah. And Dershowitz is a plagiarist and just, oh, what a, he shouldn't be in any university.
But there are consequences. And so I actually quite honestly say to my younger colleagues that you shouldn't really talk about this until you have tenure. And then once you have tenure, then it is your responsibility to talk about it. Right. Because you're one of the few people that can do it, and you can't be fired on the spot.
It's really disgusting. And that's the power of the lobby and the pressure, that they can get people fired for saying, hey, stop killing people, stop stealing houses, stop taking land. And
I mean, the thing that it can't, the thing that tenure won't stop you from, won't prevent, is from people calling you an anti-Semite. And from people calling you, you know, saying you're a racist, and that's one of the strategies that they adopt to try and silence people. And you've got to get in the film. We have Max Blumenthal, and he says, you know, essentially at some point people have, you know, they've crossed the barrier of fear, and they said, I'm going to tell the truth no matter the consequences. And I think more and more people are kind of getting to that place right now. So the film, this film. We've done The Occupation of the American Mind, I think is actually coming at exactly the right moment when this discourse has the potential to open up a little bit.
Well, I can tell you, these films, it helps others who are speaking out, even as students. Well, I was a college student when Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land came out, and like Howard Zinn autographed a book for me for my graduation present, because we started the very first, before BDS existed, we had this thing called RIP, Reality in Israel and Palestine, at College of William and Mary, and we started a divestment program, which failed, so we changed it and said we were divesting from Burma, which involved all the same companies anyway, and when we did that, there was no resistance, and it passed. But when we were doing it for Palestine, we had Hillel and everyone else, and people were like, are you anti-Semitic? Like, no, not at all, I just don't want you to killing and stealing land and, you know, really obvious stuff. And my senior year is when I went to the Palestinian Solidarity Movement over at Duke, and I met Dan Abutu, the spokesperson for the PLO, and they had all these films, and I got Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land. I showed it on campus. I wrote a letter and paid the money and did everything. Having a film out there like that and knowing there are other people who are speaking out about this, academics, because I was a 20-something-year-old young man, you know, trying to do this on our own and getting flack from everybody. And I've never been attacked so much over something that I thought was so obvious. You know, why? And I did want to divest from Burma, too. It wasn't just a tactic, but it was just something else. And to have films like this, but now there's a widespread BDS movement over all these different college campuses, and you have not only academics speaking out, but just regular people, celebrities, Roger Waters, for example. I know he's gotten a lot of flack as a musician to speak out against this issue, but the more people like him or whoever can speak out, and it doesn't destroy their career, and it's not the end of the world, and people can see that. Once that fear is lifted, I think there are a lot of people who are waiting to speak out, and the only thing that's preventing them is they don't want. I mean, it's like Holocaust denial or something. I mean, if you say anything bad about Israel, then you're either a self-hating Jew or anti-Semite, and they've got to get over that fear. Now, the worst place is a professor without tenure, because you'll get fired. But there are a lot of occupations where, or if you've already made your money or something, it's just the moral right thing to do. Do it anonymously if you want. You know, make a pen name or something. But you cannot let fear control you, because that is cowardly.
Well, it is cowardly to some degree, but it makes you complicit in what's going on. Because your silence is seen as a, I mean, it's not seen, your silence is a prerequisite to...
Well, this is the civil rights, this is the civil rights question of our era. I mean, this is, I'm sure it was really hard at some point to speak out and say, I'm okay with riding the bus with colored people or whatever. Like, you're going to get flack in the beginning, but this is, maybe that's not cowardice. Maybe the people speaking out are heroic and everyone else is just normal. Maybe we'll put it that way. We'll put a positive slant on it. But this is the civil rights question of our era. And if you are not speaking out against racial apartheid right now about what Israel is doing to Palestinians, then you can't claim that you would have what you would have done in the past for women, for blacks, for whatever, because you wouldn't have done anything. You would have just sat there, because that's what you're doing now.
Well, this is, we know that this is the subject that, you know, divides people who think that they're liberals from, I mean, I think you can't be left-wing and a progressive and be pro-Israel. I think that is an impossibility. And I think more and more, and you know, there are progressives who think they're progressive on everything except Palestine.
That's something. I would say you can't be a moral person, whether you're a Republican or whatever. You cannot be a moral human being and support Israel. You cannot support house demolitions and ethnic cleansing and call yourself a good person.
Well, you can if you think that it's the word of God and what's being played out is the word of God.
You're a crazy person.
Well, that's a third of the American population.
If you talk to God, you're religious. If God's talking to you, you're schizophrenic.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, the Presbyterian Church divested from Israel. That took a long
time. No, I don't think it's anything about me. I think it's a kind of religion. You know, it's the evangelicals.
Right. Yeah.
They put the
mental and fundamental.
Yes. I hope, as you said, I hope this film is shown as an organizing tool. And as an education tool, that, you know, people, it's not just the people, you should watch it. You should watch it and try and organize a screening of it and try and get in front of the eyes of people who wouldn't otherwise, you know, be exposed to this kind of issue.
Well, it has some really big names in the film. MJ Rosenberg's in it. He used to work for AIPAC, and they call him a self-hating Jew, and he scrubs that off. You have Stephen Walt, which Mersheimer and Walt wrote the book on The Lobby. Rula Jabrel's in there. She was at the conference last March as well. And she paid consequences when she used to work for MSNBC. And she's in there. Chomsky's in there. Norman Finkelstein, Max Blumenthal, Phyllis Bennis. So. And then, of course, there's a lot of well-known names, I think, in this film. So I hope people will go out.
And Yusuf Munir, I think, is the main person, who's the head of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation.
Oh, yeah, Yusuf Munir is in it a lot, actually. And that's, yeah, I mean, I shouldn't have started naming names because now I got to name them all. I don't know them all off the top of my head, but just remembering the people I've met.
It's been a while since I've looked at it, so I think you could do a better job than me.
Zat Holly's in it. I hope I would like to do a screening of this film here. I don't know how many English speakers I can gather, but... I could get one going in Los Angeles as well. That's where I screen my own films. But this is, I think these type of films, because you can have a lot, there's People in the Land, there's Gaza Strip, which show the brutality that children have to go through living, you know, with water rations and things like that. But like you said, you can't really start talking about that until you fix the first problem of the psychology and just general lack of knowledge of what's going on. Because people will just say in their head, yes, that's sad about that kid, but they shouldn't be shooting rockets every day. And that's what they're saying in their mind. And they don't know they're not firing rockets every day. Every time a rocket's ever been fired, it's on the news 24 hours a day. And it says, three Israelis die, and it was like the Boston bombing. The whole world knew about it. It was on television everywhere. But 72 Palestinians had been killed that same year. And none of it was reported. And that's some major bias in the American media. And how do you explain that other than it goes along with the military-industrial complex's general direction of policy and the lobby? I think you have
to... Yeah, no, it's connected with those broader structures. It's also connected... I mean, actually, we dealt with this issue in Peace Propaganda in the Promised Land, which actually I would say you should buy, but you can actually find it for free on the web somewhere. It's at the whole movie is on the web. free.
Should donate or buy or something, because that's how other films get made. As a filmmaker, I know the pain, but watch it, of course, and then, you know, kick in a donation or purchase it, you know, even after you've seen it.
If you'd like Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land for free, you should go and buy a copy of Occupation and give us a donation.
There you go. If you already saw one, you can make up for it now by buying a copy of The Occupation of the American Mind.
Right.
And that's
and what we hope is that people will use this, as I said, for education. So you get past that, the ignorance of it.
And you're allowing screenings at universities or films?
Yeah, no, we encourage screenings at university. We distribute to universities. We hope that SJP chapters, when the fall comes, will organize screenings of this, or BDS chapters will organize screenings of it. I mean, we have to be reliant upon the help of people to get this out, because it's not I wish it wasn't, but this is the one subject that the mainstream media won't deal with. Even some left-wing media won't deal with it. And so trying to get word of this out via media, even when you have Roger Waters as the voice of it. And Roger actually has been willing to do some, to do publicity for us, because he realizes how important it is to get the film out. But even with that, it's a tough sell. We can't even get onto some prominent left-wing places. I'm not quite sure what's going on. So what we're relying upon is we hope that people will watch this, will buy the film, will watch it, will share information about it on their social networks, on Twitter, on Facebook, et cetera, on Instagram. Because that's the only way this is going to get out.
It's got to be alt media. And I think you should do a little bonus chapter, maybe later, saying how difficult it was to distribute everything. Like, you approached these left-wing places that you thought would be more receptive, and they were not. Like, you should say all the places you tried to get to help promote it. And then, maybe mention the places that did promote it. This one. And say, look,
some people like you, we did an interview with the Real News Network as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And that was good. We essentially did an hour with them, with Roger and myself in the studio.
You know, they covered, the Real News Network covered the APAC conference.
I watched the APAC conference on Real News.
So, but I did it too, and my numbers were like five times as high as theirs, so I'm going to say. But I would rather have it as many places as possible, The year before I did the coverage, because C-SPAN wasn't there, and I flew there all the way from Japan, and Grant Smith's like, right, can you cover this? And so on the spot, I had to do it. Then last year, or just a few months ago, Real News Network was there, and I had no pressure, and I was like, this is great. So
now when someone else takes care of the technical stuff, it's actually very good.
Oh, yeah. I hate doing that.
As someone who has filmed a lot of conferences myself, I can tell you, when someone else does it, it's actually liberating.
Yeah, I'd use someone else's laptop and get my camera so it was something else. But we were able to cover it last year, and we got all the speeches out, and... Livy's speech went pretty viral. It's possible. But again, that when you have that many people there, I mean, prominent people from universities and all in one spot, like, that should have been nationally covered. That conference was so important. And
And, yeah, I mean, at the very least, it should have been covered by C-SPAN, at the very least, you know?
Exactly. And last year it wasn't. And they had promised to and then pulled out at the last second, yet they all covered the APAC conference, which happened a couple of days later. There was a huge protest against that, too, and that didn't get any coverage except for alternative media. But even like, you know, Democracy Later and stuff, they weren't there. You know, where are these people for these issues? They're not there. There were a lot of reporters for written press, but I noticed they didn't write anything. Because they went around interviewing people trying to, you know, find something anti-Semitic, or that's what they're hunting
for. Right, they were there for the sensational value.
And they couldn't find it. Everyone's, get out of here, you know. We're not like that. We're not talking about that. Nobody hates Jews. I'd say half the speakers there were Jewish. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, no, I mean, half the people in our film are Jewish, I would say.
Right. I mean, because nothing causes more actual anti-Semitism than the behavior of Israel, because Israel equates itself as Jews. Like, Israel, the Jews, is the same. Therefore, if you criticize Israel, you're criticizing Jews, even though it's not true. But at the same time, what they've done to themselves is you're saying, well, if Israel's Jews and Israel's engaged in all this racist behavior and stuff, then Jews are bad. See, that they've shot themselves in the foot by doing that.
No, I mean, I think the people who are really pushing anti-Semitism to the extent that it exists is actually the state of Israel itself, by equating everything it does and all its horrendous actions with Judaism. Right. And if that's a discursive trail, which is, you know, Judaism equals Israel, then actually what's wrong with anti-Semitism? So they're in danger of actually making anti-Semitism almost normal by their own behavior.
Yeah,
and
racism
becomes that's really dangerous because within anti-Israel stuff, there's very little anti-Semitism, but there are a lot of anti-Semites out there on the right wing who could use cover around this.
Right, and you will have people also, unfortunately, who will sort of mouth that, oh, they're just sticking up for Palestinians, but actually they're closet anti-Semites. And I mean, not at the conferences or anything like that, but there are people who are legitimate racist or anti-Semites who use the Palestinian issue as cover for to give them like a more acceptable pretext for their closet racism.
Well, you know, I think you could say that the reason that Trump kind of broke on this, you know, at least before the APAC conference, he was actually saying things that, you know, he would be a neutral broker between Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. Part of that was, I think, he was playing upon the anti-Semitism, you know, the rabid anti-Semitism and racism of his own base. And he knew he could say anti-Israel things and he wouldn't pay the consequence because most of his audience kind of agreed with him, but for the reasons of, you know, of anti-Semitism rather than for the reasons of, you know, the right reasons for, you know, for criticizing Israel.
Could be. I think he's. I don't think so. I think he's just really arrogant about his ability to make deals. Like, he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal, and so he. The way he went into that speech was, it'll probably be the hardest deal that you could ever make, you know, but I'm going to go in neutral because you can't go into a deal saying, well, we're going to make a compromise here, but you guys are completely out and terrible, and this is the good guy and you're the bad guy.
No, I mean, the idea that he could fit is ludicrous, but the idea that he talked about it, That was breaking the narrative. I mean, he got back in line pretty quickly.
He went and talked to APAC, and he got back in line. But I think it was just his arrogance about trying to make deals. But also, he doesn't need their money as much as everyone else because he's self-funded. Well, so he has.
No, he doesn't need it now, but he will need it as president.
If that happens. But he actually, I can't even say because Hillary scares me even more.
I mean, just as an aside, I think there's a real possibility because I think Trump is going to be able to harness together the resentment that exists for many people against the established system.
I think the backlash against the social justice warrior crowd, combined with just real visceral hate for Hillary Clinton and the Clintons, he's got a very good chance of winning it, actually. More than people realize, especially when they get in the debates.
I think it's not a foregone conclusion, and especially when I think Clinton is essentially incompetent to run the kind of campaign that's required against Trump.
Well, she can't point a finger because everything that's bad about him is bad about her, too. And so it's really hard for her to attack him on things because she's guilty of even more.
Now people hate each of them equally.
Yeah, I mean, people can hate Trump, but he wasn't defending, you know, the rapist of a 12-year-old girl or anything. Like, there's everything bad about him, and there are some terrible things, but because he's pro-torture and wants to kill people's families, and that's disgusting. But Hillary's actually done all those things, not just talked about it, but has done them. She's been killing people her whole career, so... It's just, that's why I live in Japan, you know, like I left. But I think the solution is not, you know, putting all your eggs on, it's not like waiting for like a great president to come and change everything. We can change things through Congress, we can change things through referendum, we can change things through divestment and boycotts and so on. And so I think this divestment movement among Christian churches is very important, because you're talking about tens of billions of dollars there. That are just flowing to the government of Israel, and you could cut that off if I think most Christians, not evangelicals, but most normal people could see the situation, see a film like what you've made, and see what's really happening, and say, my gosh, they're doing that to little kids, and they're really just taking bulldozers and smashing houses. That's terrible. I don't want to give money to that. That's all it would take, because you cut the money off, and they will go to the negotiation table tomorrow. Because the only way they can get away with this is because America subsidizes it.
No, an American, that's what the film is about, an American subsidy is dependent upon keeping the population passive. So the elites can act on their own. Once the pressure starts, and I agree with you, once the pressure starts coming from below, that is very bad news for Israel.
Gosh,
we finished the film by saying, actually, you know, things actually look as though they're shifting, you know, because of social media, because of things like Twitter and Facebook, because of independent sites on the internet. So you're not relying upon mainstream media anyway. That in fact, you know, young people especially are shifting.
Foreign media too. I think a little bit. I mean, just Press TV and RT, they have their own agendas, but on this issue, they're a bit more clear. Even Al Jazeera, although they're terrible on Syria, they're pretty good on Palestine. So
this film actually played on RT.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, they actually played a couple of times, and we hope we'll get an agreement with Al Jazeera pretty soon for it. But it's, yeah, I mean...
Have you talked to Netflix about it?
It's difficult to get stuff on these places. I mean, it's difficult to get any film on. I think it's even more difficult to get this film. But we that's our strategy. We're trying to do as much as we can, kind of in between, you know, the structures. We can't get into the mainstream structure, but I would love for this to be on Netflix.
I think of the mainstream, that's the most realistically doable wide distribution.
Yeah, so that's something I'm going to be. It's going to something I'm exploring. You know, and we're doing film festivals, but not in the U.S. and significantly. The film actually is opening at it's the opening night film at the Brussels Festival of Liberties in October. So we're going to do some publicity around that, and I hope to organize a screening in London as well.
But you know, it's hard to get into these organizations. That's why I just make my own.
Yeah.
I just rent a place and say I'm having a screening and invite everybody, and we can pack the house, no problem. So like, you don't need.
Well, I think that's great. I think more and more people. I hope more and more people will do that.
Well, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to do it. So we're going to have a screening.
Well, when you do the LA one, we should coordinate. I know.
I'm all for it. If anybody wants to come do a Q&A or something, you know, whoever wants to come can come. But I'm just going to invite lots of people and do a screening. And if I'm the only one there to talk about it, I will. And I'll say, hey, I had nothing to do with making it or anything, but here's the situation. But yeah, if we can coordinate that, I would love to do it. It's right there in the middle of Hollywood would be a perfect place to sting them because, some of the people in the film live around that area too, so maybe they could pop by. But I think it would be huge. And I think
that's a good way to do it. If you organize a screening just to see if anyone's who's in the film is within, you know, driving distance of where you're going to do the screening, they may well come and do a question and answer.
That's what Roger Waters did, is no one. Well, not no one, but it wasn't public that he was coming to the Stop AIPAC event. He just showed up in the audience there, and by the way, Roger Waters is here. And it was, a nice extra treat for all the people who came, because I flew in from Japan, but I had a crew there, people who drove from Kentucky, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, quite far away, to come to this conference in D.C., and it's the first one they'd ever been to as well. So we had a lot of new youth there, and then they were delighted to see Roger Waters because everyone my age is huge into Pink Floyd too. So, but it was it's something else, and yeah, I would love to have that in networking and to get into different circles too, because I feel like a lot of academics sort of are talking to each other a lot, and they need to work more with like radio hosts and people with different audiences to get these things out. So I would do it.
Well, no, I'm grateful for any help that you can offer around that. That'd be very useful.
We will get this out there, and I appreciate you doing this. Is there anything else you want to say about the lobby or charges of anti-Semitism? Or I think we covered.
No, but I would like to say something about where you can get the movie.
Oh well, that's going to be next. So tell everybody where they can buy the movie.
You can stream the movie, or you can buy a DVD at www.occupationmovie.com. Occupationmovie.com. And you can stream. So you can stream it for a minimum of $5. We hope people will give more because we need the money.
Guys, $5 is nothing. Just go get that right now and watch the film. Don't torrent the film. Don't pirate the film. Just go watch it. It's only $5. That's like one Starbucks something or whatever.
Yeah, it's like a cup of coffee, right? It's like
I don't buy $5 coffee, but $5. It's nothing to you, but it's a big deal to them because there are thousands of people listening to this right now. I mean, they could get $5,000 or $10,000 right now if you'll go watch the film, and it's worth it. It's definitely worth the $5. Think of all the work that the people put into this, and you're going to see the film. And maybe you're already sold. Maybe you already think, well, I'm already against the occupation. And this ammo is going to sharpen your arguments, you know, for others who you need to talk to about this issue. And I guarantee you're going to learn more than what you think you know. You don't know all of it. Even if you're on our side and you might think it's preaching to the choir, then buy the film to support, just to support the film, you know, and watch it and be entertained, but do it to give support to these groups, because this is the final hurdle, really. If we get this distribution out and change the American mind in that occupation, it's over. And you don't have to elect the right president or anything like that. All you have to do is change the public perception. And if public support stopped for the apartheid state, then the apartheid state would end just as it did in South Africa.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I mean, I'm not sure it would end overnight, but there would be a major change in how they could do business. Yeah.
Well, as Gideon Levy said, it could happen in months. I mean, if you talk to someone about the Berlin Wall falling or the collapse of the Soviet Union a year before it happened, it just seemed like, oh, no, the Soviet Union is this giant empire now. And within months, it all started to collapse. And this, I think, maybe I'm naive or optimistic, but I think the whole thing could fall apart very quickly if people realize what was really happening. And it's really a simple issue. I mean, you have a racial apartheid with colonies being built by people over another people. It's clearly wrong. It's completely immoral. Most of the world's against it already. The U.S. vetoes UN resolutions solo all the time. And so America's the last American kind of Canada, the last obstacles left. You get that out of the way, and everyone else is already on board. So I think it could collapse very fast, and it just takes the right film or something sometimes. You never know it has such a giant effect, like The Cosby Show. Who knew that like a comedy show was going to have such a cultural impact? So these things happen like this. They start with slowly. We started with negotiating with China by playing ping pong. You know, it starts with sports. You never know what it is that's going to be the catalyst.
I agree. I think actually there is a whole kind of social movement here. So it's not just this film. There's other films. You know, there's the work that activists do. There's the work that the church groups do, etc. I mean, so I think it's actually slowly building. And it may be at some point something will tip it over, but I have no doubt that the situation is changing around this, and that when the change comes, it actually could come. Yeah, it could possibly come very quickly.
Well, there's a link below the talk if you're listening to this on ANC, and there is a link in the description if you're listening to this on YouTube or Vimeo, where you can click through, send your $5, and start watching the film right now. You can stream it. And also on your website, they can buy a DVD as well.
Well, they can buy a DVD right there, yeah, right at that same website. So, yeah.
We'll do both if you're a high roller. You know, at least get the stream. DVD would be even better. You might have to wait for it, but you'll have the DVD, which is nice, and you'll be able to play that for others.
Yeah, playing. And if you're a student North American university, you may already have it because your library may already have it. And so when you click on that, you can click on a link for institutions. You should just click down and see if your institution is already on it, and you may be able to watch it right then.
Well, there you go. And so and share it at your college and hold a screening. You know, if you have a group or a club or something and you on the Middle East or particularly on Israel or Palestine, then check and see if you have that and have a screening at your university and, you know, have a discussion about it. I think that'd be something worthwhile as well.
No, that's what we hope. We hope people will use this and have screenings, you know, wherever they can. And, you know, especially on college campuses. It's, in one sense, it's kind of a pep rally, you know, for people who work on this issue. Because at the end, I think the film gives a lot of information about the issue, and especially about, you know, what you're going to see on media and why you're going to see it. In that sense, you mentioned it yourself, it's ammo. You know, the next time, the next war that happens, the next time that this is covered on the media, you're going to have the tools to be able to deconstruct and to understand the ideology that's coming at you. And I think a lot of time people already know that the mainstream media are very, you know, one-sided. And this, the film gives, you know, fills in the gaps and gives you real knowledge, you know, to flesh that out.
I think especially post-Second Iraq War, where they saw how much deception there was about weapons of mass destruction and anthrax and everything else, that they realize, wow, yes, every single news channel can and will lie to you about something. That happens all the time. I mean, I converted a lot of people with peace propaganda, Promised Land, my own family. I would try and talk to them about it, but you can get down and sit and watch a film, and they can see all these other academics and things that agree with me. And then the next time Israel assaulted Gaza, they would see the language that film had pointed out, like, this is what they do, and this is how they talk. And that's exactly what they were doing. And then they came back to me and they said, you know, you're right. This is what's been happening. And so, you know, sometimes convincing your family is the hardest group there is.
Absolutely. I'm in awe of you doing that.
If you can convince your family, you can convince any other family, because that we're all pretty much the same. Like, it's not all the same.
I think that's the most difficult conversations to sometimes have is with, you know, people you love around.
Right,
around the street when they clearly don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, they'll tell you exactly what they think. Strangers a little bit more objective, I think. But yeah, and I was opposing the Iraq War and they didn't, but now they've seen the light there too. So
well,
sometimes you have to lose an argument at first, but down the road they'll realize, oh, they were right.
I mean, that's the thing, you've just got to keep going over time. You know, I mean, after the first Iraq or the second Iraq War. And just before Bush was reelected, we did another film. Actually, came out the same time as Peace Propaganda, Promised Land. And that was called Hijacking Catastrophe.
Right.
9/11 and the fear and fear of, and building the American Empire. And again, looked at precisely at that, which was how not that 9/11 was an inside job. I mean, I think that is really, you know, is
well. There's a lot of there's a lot of BS about 9/11. I think. It's sad because we do see where there seems to be some Saudi state sponsorship and financing of intermediaries who gave money to hijackers. And that's stuff that you ought to flush out and figure out what was going on. But, you know, there are also people talking about holograms and whatever. So, and it's the same thing with the Kennedy assassination. I mean, there are legitimate avenues to study, but, you know, none of this, I call it Jonestown nonsense.
No, it is. It's. I mean, I think it's very unproductive because every time you're focusing on this question, you're not focusing on a really important question, and that's the. I mean, for me, that's the tragedy of conspiracy theories. It kind of sucks in a lot of people, smart people, and gets them to think about something that is essentially irrelevant, and it means that they're not thinking very productively about anything else.
Yeah, it hijacks the narrative, and I think. Categorically, conspiracy is also silly, though. I mean, we do have conspiracies, Iran Contra.
No. Obviously, we have. I mean, interests rule the world, right? That's
right.
You want to call that a conspiracy? Call it a conspiracy.
Well, I would say the more concrete way to attack 9/11 is to show how it was erroneously attached to Iraq, because we had people on television saying Muhammad Atta met in Prague and got anthrax from Iraqi officials that went to these 9/11.
Well, I was going to, but the film that we, so. Yeah, the film that we did, Hijacking Catastrophe, does exactly that. It's actually about the way that it was used to link it up to, you know, this, to the fiction of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction.
Well, you had Americans signing up to become soldiers because they thought Iraq did 9/11. I know people personally are like, well, they did 9/11, and I would just facepalm and say Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. But they believe that because that's what the vice president and Condi Rice and Tim Russert and others were saying. They were saying, hey, they may have gotten anthrax from Iraqis. And it was a lie.
No, of course it was. And so the film that we did actually shows it and shows how, you know, the 9/11 was used as a pretext, you know, for this pre-existing neocon agenda to try and, you know, take over the Middle East and try and take over Iraq specifically.
Afghanistan too.
Yeah, and watch the dominoes fall. You know, I mean, these idiots who thought, I mean, they knew nothing about the Middle East and they thought they were going to, you know, I mean, it's the arrogance of, you know.
It'll be a cakewalk and Iraqi oil will pay for the occupation. That's what Wolfowitz was saying.
No, I mean, they should. I mean, the reason they should be prosecuted is because what they did was criminal. They should also just be prosecuted for, you know, for stupidity as well. If they really believed all that stuff, they literally, you know, it's immoral that you try and that you have these plans for this area that you know nothing of. You know nothing of the people. You absolutely know nothing of the culture. You know, they just appear as this thing on a world map that you're going to take over.
See, I would argue that kind of incompetence is actually plausible deniability from benevolence. I think they knew how bad it was going to be, and that's the point. Because it wasn't incompetence to have Najeer forgeries. That has to be intentional. You can't accidentally sign the wrong guy's name on a document and pass it off as propaganda for yellow cake uranium. That is an intentional deception. So it's not just, oh, they're arrogant idiots. They're psychopathic monsters. I mean, they wanted war in Iraq for their own ideological reasons. You have a lot of Israeli partisans making the Office of Special Plans. I mean, they literally created an office within an office, the OSP, to cherry-pick and fabricate information in order to start Iraq. Sorry,
you should really watch Hijacking Catastrophe.
Well, I was...
We have a whole section. We have an interview with Karen Kwiatkowski, who was one of the people working in the, you know, the
I know. Office. I've interviewed her, too, and she saw how Israeli generals met with Douglas Feith in his office and went in unchecked, because I made a film about the same thing. I made a film called War by Deception, and to me, the big thing is you have most of the people say, oh, Bush was an idiot, and the neocons are so incompetent, and they didn't know what they're doing, and now look at what a disaster it is. And I say, no. Well, yes, he's an idiot, but... The main thing is, this was intentional, it's not blowback, this was the plan, you can go back to Oded Yanan, they were talking about dividing Iraq up and fostering sectarian violence on purpose. This is something that's been happening for a long time, it's been a long plan. And so no, it was not incompetence, this was intentional.
But they didn't realize, I mean, they may have had these plans, but they didn't realize what would happen when they tried to implement them.
Well, it's a mixed bag. So you got ABC, you got the totally incompetent people like Bush, and you have other people like Serbinsky and Kissinger and stuff who did know and didn't care. And even Dick Cheney. I mean, Dick Cheney said in 1994 the reason they didn't finish the job, or so to speak, was because it would create a quagmire. And he said you'd have Kurdish populations breaking off in the north and threatening the territorial integrity of Turkey. And he explained the whole thing. So, like, he definitely knew in the 90s. And then suddenly... He reverses his positions completely. But he's proving on film in the 90s that, yeah, it would break up. It would be like this. You'd have Sunnis here, Shiites here, Kurds here. And it's written in their own policy papers. They wrote it in PNAC. They wrote it in the Weekly Standard. They wrote down exactly what they wanted to happen. And so a portion of these guys absolutely knew what was going to happen and didn't care. And then you have another portion who naively thought, oh, it's going to be great. They're going to welcome us with flowers and all that. And so there is a bit of that, too. But the main architects of the war, not just like William Crystal and the media outfits, but the main planners of this did know what was going to happen because they've been writing about it since the 1980s.
Sure. I mean, I don't think they knew that it was, I don't think they knew about ISIS. I mean, I think they knew this would, these things would split up and there would be different kinds of tensions. I don't think they realized that by putting in the kind of politicians they did, the kind of the Sunni politicians they did into Iraq, you know, like Maliki, that it was going to essentially, you know, disrupt the entire situation. So, you know, but no one can predict that kind of stuff.
Well, our own DIA said they did know that we were creating a Salafist principality in Syria, and that was the goal. So somebody knew.
Yeah.
You know, it depends what you mean when you say they, but of our own intelligent assessment, Michael Flynn came out and said it too, and they were saying, look, we are creating, they didn't have the name ISIS yet, but they said Salafist principality of these Wahhabis, and that is a program that started in Kosovo. I mean, the current ISIS commander is a Kosovar, and he was trained at one of these Saudi madrasas, and that goes all the way back to Hillary Clinton's legacy. It's right across the street from the big statue of Bill Clinton's waving at the madras where these guys come from. These proxy armies that have been trained and fed this philosophy of Wahhabism in these madras schools has been going on since the U.S. started doing that and financing it through BCCCI in Afghanistan from the Safari Club's inception in 1976. So someone knew, because we've been using proxy forces. We use them in Iran-Contra. We use them in Kosovo. We use them in Afghanistan. And so ISIS is not some brand new thing. This is just what we've been doing for many decades, is financing Islamic militants. We did it with Jandala. We did it with MEK in Baluchistan. We've did it with Mujahideen, the Taliban, even Al-Qaeda, and of course now ISIS, the FSA, Afar al-Sham, and al-Nusra have all had support from the United States at one point or another. So I say they did know about ISIS, and that was a plan, because they've been doing it. But that's my decision. Okay. I got triggered. No. Sorry. But I think everyone should watch the both films and Peace, Propaganda, and Promised Land. Get it all. Guys, get the DVD and watch
this. Hijacking Catastrophe.
Yeah. Hijacking Catastrophe and the what was the book again about the Cosbys? I'm interested in getting that.
The book is called Enlightened Racism.
Enlightened Racism. That's fascinating. I've never.
And it's essentially, I mean, if everyone reads it, they should actually, instead of, you know, Cosby is from history and it's important, but you should just substitute Obama for Cosby. And that's the basis of his success, especially among liberals.
Does the Cosby book make you sleepy? Just kidding. Come on. As a comedian, he'd appreciate that, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to me, because I always thought about that. I've never thought about writing a book about it. But I thought about, you know, I think the Cosby Show had a really big impact. But I wonder if anyone's ever written or said anything about that. So, yes, someone has. So I really thought that. I was thinking about that. Like, the impact that television shows or a movie or even like music, like Japan and Korea, have gotten a lot closer because of K-pop and J-pop. It sounds very silly, but I'm very serious about this. Like,
I don't know. I think having cultural affinities, or, you know, I mean, that's a very important part of being human. So,
it takes the wool off the eye, and then they start to see. It's sort of the first door open, and then they realize other things. So, that's what I'm saying. So we got to get this film out there, guys. $5, and you can also get a DVD. And look for the screening in LA, because I don't know when that's going to be, but we're going to start organizing that now. So let's have it. And
okay,
thank
great.
You so much for coming on the show. Sorry for going off on the neocons. That's my thing, though. So.
Okay, no, it was a great pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.